when I was in my 20s, I thought I knew everything. And then I realized, especially when I started my research in my doc program, how little I knew. And I don't know where that came from, you know? And so that's my advice. Listen, 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 listen and learn. You know, be a little kid again. And you'll be surprised how much people will tell you and share with you. You know, 100% of the problems are known at the lowest levels in organizations. And only 4% of those problems, the knowledge of them there, that is, make it to the top. 4%.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to founders and executives about what they see differently in identifying top talent that others may not. If this is your first episode, thanks so much for joining us. We're glad to have you. For our longtime listeners, welcome back. Appreciate you so much. Please download and subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure to give us a high rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Rob Boghossian. He is faculty at George Washington University and also founder at RVB Associates. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited for this conversation. I want to dive right into it. Now, a little bit about RVB Associates. We definitely want to talk about it, but it sounds like my understanding is consulting in the leadership development and succession planning space in particular. I'm really interested because you had a long-standing corporate career prior to opening up your own consulting firm. Interested what kind of led you down this road, and in particular, why this was your area of focus?
Well, that's a great question. And I wish I had this fabulous plan to share with you, like some career trajectory that I thought up, but I didn't. So I was internal at a global financial services organization. And I just woke up one morning and said, you know, I think I'm going to do this on my own. So it was quite spontaneous. And I went to my management team and I asked if what would happen if I decided to do this? Can I count on you to be my first client? And the short answer was absolutely. We hope you don't go that route, we want you to say. But if you do, yes, absolutely. So they were my first client. And then it just never stopped from there. I guess I was very, very fortunate.
Wow. So like you had this like aha moment. You come in and you tell your employer, hey, I no longer want to work here, but I definitely want to still keep doing what I'm doing and just do it through a different channel. And they were gracious enough to say, all right, Rob, we'll make it happen. You must have made quite an impression on them. You must have been providing a lot of value to them in that role.
Well, I like to think that's true. However, on a practical note, we had the calendar scheduled out through the end of the year.
Okay. Had them over the proverbial barrel. Listen, I love it. And that opportunity is what led to you kind of having success over the next 19 years with your company. So awesome story. How did you get into HR in the first place? Did you fall into it or was this an intentional move?
No, it wasn't an intentional move. It was quite serendipitous. So I was a finance major in undergraduate school. And I was working for a financial services firm in Boston, a very prestigious one, which is kind of like a Goldman Sachs. And I thought, so now after I figure out the equation, all I have to do is rinse and repeat. And how long am I going to do this? So that thought scared me. And while I was having that scary thought, the business was growing exponentially. We really couldn't hire people fast enough and move them up the learning curve fast enough for the business needs. So I guess I was really good at what I was doing. And the management there said, hey, can you put something together and train people as they come in the door? That's how I got into it. So I was never a classic HR person, always in leadership development and then executive development. My research is in culture, organizational culture, specifically cultures of voice and cultures of silence. So it kind of evolved.
I love that. We're going to talk about cultures of voice and cultures of silence in a minute. One of the things that really interests me about one of your areas of specialization is you've done and delivered large succession plans for chief executive officers for very large companies. And I'm just interested, like, how do you even get started with that? Is that, you know, you come in and obviously you're looking to identify talent within the team, but I bet they're all vying. Everybody, once you get to that level of an organization, you're vying for that. Has your recommendation ever said, you know, we've got to look externally because we don't have the people internally? Like, I'm just interested, like, walk me through that approach and process of how you ultimately deliver something that the customer is satisfied at the end when it comes to something as big as a CEO succession plan.
Well, first the board says we better have a CEO succession plan. That's number one. And then the next step is the CHRO came to me and said, we need to have a CEO succession plan. Can you help us? Absolutely. I mean, I had never done a CEO succession plan before. I'd done succession planning, but not that. So I went to my research mode and said, okay, well, let's see what distinguishes high-performing CEOs from those who are, I guess, well-placed. And let's do that by correlating performance, human performance, CEO performance, with firm performance. So I looked at CEOs who were considered high-performing relative to firm performance consistently over a greater than 5-year period so that it removes the anomalies. I came up with a model, and then I looked at other research that just said, you know, here are some things that executives do if they're really good, but it was kind of anecdotal. So I thought, okay, well, let's take a look at what the company needs to do in the next 5 years, 1 year, 3 year, 5 years. Because you can't go, I didn't think you could go further than that because the business is changing, customer needs change, IoT, the technology, AI, everything's changing, right? And so a succession plan needs to be flexible, nimble, responsive. And so I put that model together and peer reviewed it and until we reached agreement. And the agreement was, yep, this is it. This is the set of practices that we want modeled in the CEO suite. Okay, let's take a look at the talent that we're going to use to consider for that space and rate them according to this objective criteria. This was all research-based criteria. This wasn't me or anybody internally saying, hey, how about we do this? And hey, how about we, let's include that. So this wasn't some, you know, put everything in a matrix, including the kitchen sink. It was research-based, reliable, trustworthy, rigorous research. And that's what drove the model, which informed the internal assessment process. And that drove the internal development process.
So I don't know if you have a take on this, but you know, there's been some, you know, CEO, especially taking over for a very, very successful CEO, it's a really hard act to follow, right? If I look back at, you know, Jack Welch to Jeff Immelt at GE, or I look at Bill Gates, you know, they had Steve Ballmer in between Satya Nadella, Steve Jobs to Tim Cook, I think we're still kind of deciding, right? What is it about that role in particular that when you follow somebody of such, you know, acclaim and success, what makes it so hard to be the second act? Any thoughts there?
Well, it's the business trajectory. The business is most likely in a different space. So Bill, having worked in that organization for a few years from the outside doing values-based leadership, Bill brought something very different from what Steve Barr brought and his successor. So Bill was the entrepreneur. Bill was the guy who was open and curious and pushing the organization. And Steve was a little bit different. The organization
guy, right?
Leveled out, and it was how do we do this better and do it faster and do it cheaper. But Bill really was the idea guy. And the third successor, he's there now, and it was, okay, we're in stage 3, and we better figure out how to reinvent ourselves, because if we don't, we're going to be broke in 10 years out of money. And at that point, they had $60 billion with a B, cash in the bank. But that sort of sets a tone for, you know, steady as she goes, don't rock the boat. And that the new CEO said, no way. He walked out on a stage and said, here's the burning platform, folks. And people sat up and straight and said, oh my God, yeah, right. We've been fat, dumb, and happy for too long. And that's not a judgment. It's just sort of human behavior, you know?
The evolution of a company too, right?
It
at
is.
The end of the day, like it's Satya Nadella who you're talking about. And he was the first one to come out and say, on our current trajectory, we are going to be gone if we don't pivot and change. And now I think it's a $1 trillion market cap and they're as more successful than they've ever been. And you got to give them a lot of credit, but they went through those years kind of in the middle with Ballmer, right? and didn't have that. They had that stagnation. They had that. So I agree with you. I think a lot of it comes down to timing. I think a lot of times a CEO steps down because of it starting to plateau, or the exponential success is maybe starting to change. And then you enter a different world with a new leader. And a lot of times, for fair or for not, that leader bears the brunt of whatever the coming results are. Because it's very hard to be an organization like this, if not impossible, throughout the entire, you know, history of your company, right? So
yeah, it is. And then to jumpstart it and get it going again, Satya, you know, he was brave. He told the truth. You know, he wasn't going to collude with the organization. He was a brave guy. So I think that's part of it, to know where the organization is, what it has to do next, and to make sure that those characteristics, those traits, that experience is in place. But it's interesting, when I did the research, I found that there were two distinguishing characteristics, two traits that distinguish the high-performing CEOs from those who were workplace. And this is what they were: openness and curiosity. As well as the ticket into the game. You got to be smart. But those were the two distinguishing characteristics. And if you think about it, openness and curiosity, that says a lot. I mean, if you are open, you're inviting ideas, you have a positive attitude toward divergent thinking, you are asking more questions than you're making statements. And so that wraps its arm around the culture. So people begin to think, okay, I can ask questions here. I don't have to be in the know all the time, every time. And that's what stimulates the thinking. That's what pushes the innovative thought process. And, you know, sometimes I think CEOs don't always know the power that they have.
Interesting. That's really good insights. I love that. Openness and curiosity. Really, really good insights. You wrote a book called Breaking Corporate Silence. And you think silence in the workplace is one of the least talked about, no pun intended, issues that exist in these corporate workspaces. You know, I hadn't heard of this term until we talked about it. Can you describe what this corporate silence phenomenon is?
Basically, it's when employees willfully withhold important work-related information, not because they're insidious, but because they have received messages, implicit or explicit, in the system, and I mean the organizational system, that say, keep your mouth shut and your head down. You have a good idea? That's nice. Go home and talk about it, but not here. It is the most high-risk type of culture that I can think of today. And we don't need any more proof than occasionally we pick up the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and this is public knowledge, so I'm going to say this. When windows blow out of a 737, we can't say, oh, what a surprise. Gee, how did that happen? Nobody knew about that. That is not true. And when I see these, what I call organizational crises, described in the newspaper, I can pretty much pinpoint, not, oh, aren't you great? But after a while, when you study this, I can pinpoint, like, okay, this is a culture of silence right here. This is perfect. Great example. They're all over the place.
Yeah, give me some examples. What are some famous examples in corporate history of this kind of...
Well, there's one, Boeing. There's one. My alma mater, Wells Fargo. The phantom bank account creation emanated from a dictum that Wells Fargo customers would use an average of, I think it was 7 services and products of the institution. Well, you had to have goals... in order to meet that objective, that marketing objective. And the only way that people could figure out how to do it was to create these phantom bank accounts. And one of the pieces of research I read was when somebody raised their hand and said, this doesn't feel right to me. This just doesn't, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. I think this is illegal. And this person was told to, quote, shut up. You know what your goals are. So figure it out, something like that. And that was the start of it. So when the CEO said, I don't know anything about this. I didn't know. I know nothing. I see nothing. No, that's not true.
So companies like Enron and WorldCom and like all these different companies that had these massive, you know, PR, you know, ethics issues that have led to, you know, the destruction of their companies and the destruction of many careers, many times it comes up from people not feeling like they can raise their hand and say, this doesn't feel right, this doesn't look right, this doesn't sound right, and then things just keep going.
Exactly. So Bluebell ice cream. And then there was most recently Boar's Head. I can say this because it's public information.
I saw that they had some real issues in terms of at one of their big facilities, I think in Virginia or somewhere. And they actually had a guy that they hired that was like raising the bell and saying, this isn't good, this can't happen. And they basically, I guess, fired him and like shunned him and put him down. And then eventually they had a Wisteria outbreak that went out and affected everybody who ate this liverwurst. And if it sounds like I know this these details immensely, well, I eat a lot of Boar's Head and I wanted to make sure that I was okay. So I had to check out what the problem was.
Exactly. And the twin of that story is the Bluebell ice cream story. The two manufacturing facilities, one in the southeast and one in the southwest, and two women raised their hand and said to their supervisor, you know, they're mixing the whatever it is they mix. And they said, oh, you know, something doesn't smell right. Literally doesn't smell right here. Be quiet and get back to work. Ah, okay. And everybody heard it. So, shut up and do your work. And they almost went bust. They had to get a loan, $175 million, which, you know, for a company that size, medium-sized firm, Kohlberg, KKR had to loan the money to stay afloat. They almost went out. And you know, when you think about what is the opposite of that, really? Something doesn't smell right? What doesn't smell right? Tell me more about that. So we have to know what the signs of silence are. And I know this from my research, and intervene, you know, but it starts with the mindset of the leader to believe that people are doing, they're acting in good faith. They want to do what's right for the company versus they're going to do things to get out of doing work. I mean, that's a really negative mindset. So we have to shift the mental mindset of the leader and help leaders figure out there are six common signs of silence in organization. And to your point, it doesn't denounce itself because of what it is, right? So I went all the way back in my research to the Titanic, which was a great example of a culture of silence, right? Because before the maiden voyage, the engineers were given 15 minutes to talk about lifeboat safety. The other folks in the meeting talked for 3 hours about the color of the first class cabin carpet. So the engineers were like, yeah, okay, we're not important. This is not an important issue, right? So forget it. Never mind. And we know the history. But this is very typical of what happens. So it's scary, it's high risk, and it's avoidable.
Good lessons for the leaders listening in on this. You know, goes back to being curious. You hear something's wrong, then you should be curious about finding out and open to the idea that not everything's perfect before you get in a lot bigger trouble. See how we all tied that together here. Let's bring it back. You know, this is what they call a segue in the industry. I also want to talk about your book on the 7 myths of leadership. So let's talk about that. What are the 7 myths of leadership? Can you give us a brief description about them?
Oh, I got to name all of them? Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah, you just name your favorites if you don't got
all of them. My favorite.
I mean, you did write the book, Rob. But go ahead.
I know. All right. My favorite is there's no such thing as a dumb question. But don't ask one. Just know that that's the platitude that we want every leader to salute by that one.
So you're saying that's a cliche thing that leaders say, but really you're either in explicitly or implicitly punished for asking dumb questions, correct?
Yeah. You should know that, right? Yeah, that's the common. You should know that. Or you get the eye roll. I can't believe, didn't I talk about this? Didn't I? And, you know, leaders, everything a leader does, says, doesn't do, doesn't say, everything's under a microscope. So a leader can stop a conversation in a group setting by raising their eyebrows. Just like that. It's so easy. And that gesture goes around the culture like wildfire. Don't ask any questions when you're in a meeting with whoever, because you should have seen what happened to Mary Jane. You should have seen what happened to Jose. Oh my God, don't do it. Okay. People aren't going to check that out. They're like, hey, we were told not to say anything in your meetings. Is that true? No one's going to do that. It's just, it's accepted in the associate culture as the truth. And, it, you know, it's really easy to shape a culture of silence, but it's not easy to break it down and shift it.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
I appreciate you allowing me to ask some stupid questions here. What's another one that stands out to you? Another myth of leadership? Okay.
All right. No such thing as a dumb question. Here's another one. I have an open door policy here. We have an open door policy here. The bottom half's closed, but the top half is open. But don't come in. I'll tell you whether you can come in. Okay? So not always. And if people believe that and they walk in and they sit down, I want to talk to you about something. Oh, great. Can I get back to you? Which never happens. I'm not saying all the time, you know. But enough time so that the associate culture starts to process that. Yeah, open door, my foot. There's no open door around here. The other one is nice leaders finish last.
This is not true. This is a myth.
This is a myth.
Okay, because I want to talk about this one. This is one that I'm actually kind of working with through my head, right? Where I've had some different phases and evolution of myself as a leader throughout my career, especially as the founder of a company. Yeah. Grew it with high intensity and a competitive edge and, you know, helping push, like nothing crazy, but just like, you know, my intensity was a big part of our company's growth and success. And I shaped and formed a lot of people here that eventually became, you know, the employees that have really driven the company to next step. And then I would say over the last 4 or 5 years, as I became CEO, I was in the operations role anymore. And I became more the face of the business and everything that was going on over the last 4 or 5 years, that my tone shifted a little bit and I didn't bring the same level of intensity. And I wanted to create an inclusive environment that felt secure and safe and where you could ask these questions and do these things, which is also a very good thing, but also can go a little bit far. And sometimes the performance, right, followed that in a degree. So threading that needle has been something that I've been working on that I think every great leader needs to at some level. That personal drive and that drive to hold high performance standards, but also be a leader that people want to work with and not somebody that you want to get away from as soon as possible, or somebody that you believes in you and has good intent for you. So tell me a little bit about the myth of the nice guys can't finish, you know, first, and really what your belief is in that space.
So this is all research based, right? So you could, because you're the boss and you hold the checkbook, you can scare one of your associates nearly to death. You can scare them into a state of frozenness. I don't think that's a word, but it is now. Just by criticizing them, not that you would, but because you have the power. And so appealing to the human side of the business, to listen to people, to know what makes them tick, for example. When you have an opportunity that's in your in-basket, I don't even think there is such a thing, I'm dating myself, but you know what I mean, my intake. You know who to delegate it to because you have a clear sense of who loves to do what and why. Now, there are some things that we have to do just because we have to do them. But if people know that you're going to have their back and that you're interested in their development and their growth and their learning, even in their current job, they are going to protect your back because they know you have theirs. If they don't think you have their back, then they're not going to have yours. It's kind of simple, right? And so I'm studying the neuroscience of empathy. And it's really fascinating to know how quickly, milliseconds, the adrenal system oxygen can dump cortisol into your body. It's a fraction of a second. So we take in information, hearing, visual, and in a nano, we could be in a state of like, oh my God, well, I don't even know what to do, right? Just stop, cortisol dump, or adrenaline, right? All these stress hormones that take our attention away from doing really good, healthy work. And as leaders, we don't want to do that. We don't want to cause the adrenal system to dump stress chemicals in our body, our workers' bodies. We want them to do the opposite. We want serotonin. We want oxytocin. We want the feel-good chemicals, because that's what people thrive on. They'll go to town for you. You know, you've got high performance standards. Your folks know what your performance standards are. And if you share that value with them, like my colleague Stan Slapp says, your folks will have your back. They will protect that value as if it were their own. It's when they don't know, when they speculate, the anxiety rises. So there's so much in terms of human connectivity that we don't know about. And there's a lot that we do know about. But the brain is very interesting, and it reacts very quickly to situations that drive stress. So anything that leaders can do to reduce it is a benefit for performance. It does correlate to firm performance, all told.
That's great insight. I love that. I hope everyone else is learning as much as I am on this conversation. So that was really great stuff. I do want to talk about hiring, which I think is an adjacency to a lot of the things that you do that are more traditionally falling into the talent management space. Super interested, because I'm sure you've advised or you've done your own hiring before. So I'm just interested to kind of get, you know, some questions to better understand kind of your philosophy in this space. So I guess that's where we'll start. Do you have a core philosophy for hiring, whether you're advising a client or whether you're looking at bringing somebody into your own organization?
So there are so many myths about how we hire people, like especially the interviewing methodology. I've heard people say, oh, I am so tough, and I give people puzzles to solve or something, some problem. I ask, well, why are you doing that? Well, I want to see the common answers. I want to see how people respond under stress. Okay, well, why would you help me understand, why would you create an artificial stress situation on top of an event that's already stressful? Wouldn't you rather see how people have responded in the past to unforeseen circumstances or some jolt?
Can I just put my hand up real quick? I literally had this conversation 2 hours ago with somebody. I went to lunch with a CIO, and we were talking about the fallacies of the interview process. And one of the things I brought up to them is exactly what you're talking about right now, where some people create like these like trivia questions, right? And like these things, like how many pizzas were sold in Florida in 2024? And their answer is, well, I want to see how they think. I want to, like you said, put them in adverse conditions and see how they think on their feet. And my question to you would be, you are able to understand how they handle a complex problem or how quickly they think on their feet in much more contextual ways. That's going to be much more insightful into the person that you're actually getting for the role. For example, how would you deal with a large data set of incomplete information that you needed to make a decisive decision and recommendation on, right? Have you done that throughout your career? And how would you go about handling that from a methodology perspective? And, you know, when you faced, you know, an advert, what was the last, like one of the things I like to ask in an interview is, tell me the last conflict that you had in the workplace and how you handled it, right? And when you went and what the end result ended up being. Now, in this way, I am getting somebody to think on their feet pretty quickly, right? Because you got a recall, right? I see how recently they had conflict that they had to deal with, and that there's somebody that typically runs from it or runs to it. And I'm getting an idea of how they think through a situation where there's an emotional quotient response, there's an intelligence quotient response. And so I just think that like sometimes people get in their own head about, it's really an ego thing at the end of the day, if I'm being honest. They want people to say, oh, what a brilliant question, or, oh man, you're the best interview I've ever been around. It has more to do with you as the interviewer than it has to do with what you're trying to learn. That's my hot take and my belief. I didn't mean to interject, but it sounds like we're on the same page.
That's perfect. You're exactly spot on. How have you done this in the past? Think about a critical situation that you've handled where you didn't have all the information you need, you had to find it, there was nobody to help you find, and how you handled it. Boom, shut up and listen. I call it the shut up and listen rule. How about that? And just, you know, be quiet. And you said it. I had to learn, right? I don't want to artificially stimulate somebody's adrenal system to freak them out in the moment. No, you want to, and it sounds like you do this, you want to make them feel comfortable, like, hey, we are best buds, you and me, right here, best buds. So you get real, rich, authentic data. That's what you want, not some made up.
You need to create a candidate experience. Like, one, I have a lot of recommendations on interviewing, but creating a great candidate experience where somebody wants to come work with you, work for you, and truly understand what that means in the interview process, that's success. One of the ways that I like to see how they handle different situations is I like to have the interview process include an on-site interview, maybe a lunch interview or grab coffee, right? Try to be in different environments, build that rapport, right? Get to see them in different spaces and places. Not like I see some people be like, I'm putting them through this 18 interview gauntlet to see if they can survive it and how they handle adversity. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're getting a manufactured fake response. And many times people are going to pull out of your process altogether because you're trying to take a process that really should be about, to your point, building rapport, making somebody feel comfortable so you get their authentic self and take down the veneer of what they think you want to hear, more so than creating this like obstacle course that anybody who gets to the end must be good enough to work with me. I highly doubt that there's a high correlation there. And in fact, you might just find somebody that's desperate for the job, and that's actually a relatively poor correlation to how much success somebody's actually going to have in the job than in somebody that is a passive candidate that you need to excite and entice to see what it's like to come work at your company and work with you. You agree with that?
Exactly. I agree with you 100%, right? Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, follow-up question. What's your favorite question to ask in an interview? What's something that you think drives like really great insights?
Well, I start really, really wide. So I start with, you know, give me the headline news version of your role right now. Boom, shut up, listen. Ah, okay. Tell me, if it's a leadership role, tell me the two leadership scenarios that you feel most proud of today. Ones where you say to yourself, I hit the ball out of the park. And then I just shut up. Well, I'm not sure what you want to hear. I just want to hear a story. That's all. And then I listen. And I listen. And the follow-up questions are, so when you were confronted with that X, Y, and Z, what were you thinking? That's A. B is, what did that feel like? I want to know how this person thinks. I want to know if they're self-reflective enough, self-aware enough to identify their feelings. Because then the other critical event questions, now I can begin to see patterns in how they think and how they feel. So for example, in a leadership role, I want examples of leaders who are self-reflective, those who gain insight, those who no matter what the outcome is, they're learning something, versus those who are other-centered. I learned that the marketing people never, they always, they shouldn't, they can't, they will. Or I learned that that one doesn't, you know. So if the reasoning is other-centered, I'm going to ask, have questions. Make sense?
Yeah, totally. I love that insight. I really love it. I'll tell you one I like to do for self-awareness, because I actually think this is a very, very critical thing to understand about somebody, especially if you're going to work with me. I need you to have a sense of self-awareness. I like to ask people, tell me a common misconception about you and who the real you is. It's very good visibility and insight into how the world sees them, how they reflect on that, and what they think is actually different and what people don't really see. And so you get a really, that's a hard question to fake, right? And not get some deep insight into somebody's soul. The other thing I'm noticing about you, Rob, is our AI software, it actually analyzes the interview on a lot of levels, one of which is how much you talked versus they talked and what are the topics you covered. And I already know right now, if I'm looking at Dr. Rob's interview with somebody and concluding this interview right now, it's going to be 5% him, shut up and listen, and then letting them talk and be their authentic self. I love that. That's what leads to a great rapport. Because one other thing I know is people love talking about themselves. They love kind of going over who they are. And by the way, if they leave, even if they've done 5% of the talking, they've done 95%, they're going to feel like they had a great conversation because that's usually how it works, right?
I don't want to do the talking in an interview. I know. I've already got the job. You got to talk. You have to do the
talking. You in this one. Let me ask you this. If I asked you about a memorable interview experience, maybe it's one that you heard secondhand or you were involved in. You know what? I'm even interested if it's a sales, interview in terms of RVB. Anything that jumps out? Anything that was kind of crazy or fun or exciting in terms of a memorable story? You don't have to name names.
No. All right. You know what? There are two bad ones come up. Is that okay?
Those are the best ones. Let them go.
Good bad example. Okay. So in one interview that I had, the interviewer was reading from a piece of paper and never looked at me, not once. Reading, see spot run, see Jane run, see, just like that, monotone. And I was getting a little annoyed. That was one, like, really?
Candidate experience, you didn't take that job, I know that.
Then in another interview, this is gross. Somebody was eating their lunch and while they were talking, and the food was like in mush, like chewed food was like hanging from their lips. It was gross.
Ugh. See, now listen, I've been on a few lunch interviews. I'm going to give some advice for those that go on lunch interviews, okay? Order a salad, okay? And lay off the ribs. That's a bad call, okay? Maybe go easy on the onions, right? You know, like you don't want to have like some big fried chicken. Like that's another self-awareness test, by the way. I got to be honest with you. So yeah, that left a bad impression. That's something that poor guy or gal doesn't even realize it, but they left a bad impression because they just they didn't mind their manners in terms of their eating. So I'm glad you survived both those. What about when you miss on somebody? Is there like a theme you look back on or something that you had to learn as you went through this that you'd misread a situation? It's because of X, anything like that?
Yeah. You know, there's one in particular. I hired somebody as an instructor, a technical instructor. And I looked at the education background, the formal background, and I let that sway me. And this person was charming. And I didn't do a good job because when this person started the work, they were like a school teacher in the third grade. I was mortified. I knew immediately that I had hired the wrong person. And that didn't, this is where we are right now. So we had to embark on a development plan. And this person didn't think that there was anything wrong with this style. But, you know, when you're training adults in a technical context, you really have to be cognizant, aware of the adult learner and how different it is from child. I didn't know anything about grade school teaching. I didn't even think it was there, but there was this mental model of what does it mean to be an instructor? And I missed it. So it meant I had to go down this development plan that I hadn't counted on. We had to sort of back up for the readiness and roll forward.
You think about the time spent on an interview and making sure you put your best foot forward to get it right versus the time of making that wrong hire and what it takes to unwind that untold thousands of dollars in opportunity cost tied to that, you know?
Oh my God, it's enormous. And I wasn't sure at the time that I realized the mistake, whether or not this person was going to make it. I hoped that they would. We had honest conversations about my values, my methodology versus what I was seeing. And so I knew I had to be supportive because it's my fault, you know? And so what I recall from the interview process was there was a lot of pressure to bring somebody on board because there were multiple open slots. And I think I just looked the other way. It's possible, but I learned from it. It's better to have an empty slot than it is to have a slot incorrectly filled. I mean, I'm
wrong person on the wrong seat, right? For sure.
Yeah. So that's my example.
All right. Well, good. I appreciate that you sharing that. Let's take it a little bit of a different direction. So I want to know a little bit about you personally, Rob. What do you do for fun?
So I golf.
Okay.
I
What's your favorite? You're down here in South Florida, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a favorite public course you go to?
No, I go to a place, you know, regularly.
Okay.
So I'm still trying to master the course. Even, you know, if you play golf, you know every shot's different. So I'm a left-handed golfer. And there's a lot of water in Florida. And I spend half my time in Massachusetts on Cape Cod. I'm a Bostonian, right? I'm just down here in the winter. So I have a slice off the tee box sometimes, a lot of times. And the water holes they're all left. The bodies of water are all left. And a left-handed slice.
Unforgiving for a lefty.
Oh, my God. I just smile. I just
laugh. Do you have any golf tips for – listen, I've been golfing for only the last 4 or 5 years. I'm still working on my game. Any great tips that help change your game for the better?
Keep your head down and your swing smooth like a broom. You know?
Swish. That's like it. A broom. I'm going to remember that.
Don't pick your head up.
So. Being a Boston guy, do you have a favorite sports team up there?
I like all of them. I like to think of myself as a loyal fan. You know, a lot of us in Boston, once the chips are down, we're like, oh, they stink. No, I'm not going there.
Stay
I'm like,
by through and through, huh?
Yeah, come on, let's stay in there. Let's help the team out. Let's go. I live in a place of Cape Cod. The Patriots owner is on the other side of the community. So I like to think of myself as a strong.
Good old Bob Kraft made a big hire yesterday, Mike Vrabel. So good luck to the Patriots going forward, man. I love it. Do you have a good book you read recently that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Yes, I do. If you're into the medical healthcare world, there's a book that I'm just finishing right now that I love. It's called Deep Medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's about how artificial intelligence is making a difference in the healthcare industry. It's written by Dr. Topol, T-O-P-O-L. He's the head of research at Scripps Memorial. And he's brilliant. And there's another one that's been a favorite of mine forever and ever. And it was written by a very, very dear friend and colleague, Stan Slap, S-L-A-P, called Bury My Heart in Conference Room B. And it's all about values-based leadership. And I think every leader should have to read it. Bury My Heart in Conference Room B. Stan Slap. Brilliant man. I've traveled the world with him doing values-based leadership in major successful organizations. And it is one of the best reads that any leader will have.
Love that. All right. Deep Medicine and Bury My Heart in Conference Room B by Stan Slap. Okay. Love it. Last question for me, sir.
Okay.
If you had any advice to give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now, what would it be?
Open your mind and close your mouth.
Okay. You want to expound on that, or is that just leave the silence out there?
You know, when I was in my 20s, I thought I knew everything. And then I realized, especially when I started my research and my doc program, how little I knew. And I don't know where that came from, you know? And so that's my advice. Like, be curious. Learn everything you can. Listen and learn. Ask questions, you know, be a little kid again, and you'll be surprised how much people will tell you and share with you. You know, 100% of the problems are known at the lowest levels in organizations, and only 4% of those problems, the knowledge of them there, that is, make it to the top. 4%, that's a big drop. So ask, learn, you know, listen, you want to know how your organization's doing, the lowest people in your organization, sit down and ask them, what are you doing? What are you working on? What do you think about the job here? What do you think about these products? Ask, and learn.
That's good. Listen, Dr. Rob, I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let everybody listen to this podcast. I had a fantastic time. I really appreciate you joining me. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Look forward to talking to you soon, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you. Stay well.
You too, Rob.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.